Socialism, A Very Short Introduction, written by Michael Newman.
Introduction. In 1867, Karl Marx ended the first volume of his monumental work, Das Kapital, on a triumphant note. A point would be reached, he argued, when the capitalist system would burst asunder, and at this stage, the knell of capitalist private property sounds. The expropriators are expropriated. For more than 100 years, many socialists believe, and many of their opponents feared, that Marx had been right. Capitalism was doomed and would be replaced by socialism. How things have changed. In recent years, and particularly since the collapse of the Soviet bloc between 1989 and 1991, a dramatic reversal has taken place. It is now capitalism that is triumphant. And many regard socialism as an historical relic which will probably die out during the course of the current century. I do not share this belief. And the final chapter of this book seeks to demonstrate the continuing and contemporary relevance of socialism. But whether or not the reader will agree with this conclusion, I hope that the book will at least provide clarification and discussion as a basis for judgment. The first and crucial question is, what is socialism? Those who attack or defend socialism often take its meaning as self-evident. Thus, the opponents of all forms of socialism have been keen to dismiss the whole idea by equating it with its most repellent manifestations, particularly the Stalinist dictatorship in the Soviet Union from the late 1920s until 1953. Similarly, its proponents have tended to identify socialism with the particular form that they have favored. Lenin, therefore, once defined it as Soviet power plus electrification, while a British politician, Herbert Morrison, argued that socialism was what a labor government does. Yet socialism has taken far too many forms to be constricted in these ways. Indeed, some have viewed it primarily as a set of values and theories, and have denied that the policies of any state or political party have had any relevance for the evaluation of socialism as a doctrine. This purist position lies at the other extreme from that of Lenin and Morrison, and is equally unhelpful. In fact, socialism has been both centralist and local, organized from above and built from below, visionary and pragmatic, revolutionary and reformist, anti-state and statist, internationalist and nationalist, harnessed to political parties and shunning them, an outgrowth of trade unionism and independent of it, a feature of rich industrialized countries and poor peasant-based communities, sexist and feminist, committed to growth and ecological. One way of discussing so diverse a phenomenon is to claim that all forms of socialism share some fundamental characteristic, or essence, by which the doctrine as a whole may be defined. Certainly this would simplify analysis. But this essentialist approach normally degenerates into rather dogmatic assertions about the nature of true socialism and becomes a weapon to use against the heretics. However, there are equal dangers in defining socialism so broadly that the subject cannot be analyzed meaningfully. This book seeks to overcome these contradictory dangers by taking the following minimal definitions of socialism as guidelines. In my view, the most fundamental characteristic of socialism is its commitment to the creation of an egalitarian society. Socialists may not have agreed about the extent to which inequality can be eradicated, or the means by which change can be effected, but no socialist would defend the current inequities of wealth and power. In particular, socialists have maintained that under capitalism, vast privileges and opportunities are derived from the hereditary ownership of capital and wealth at one end of the social scale, while a cycle of deprivation limits opportunities and influence at the other end. To varying extents, all socialists have therefore challenged the property relationships that are fundamental to capitalism, and have aspired to establish a society in which everyone has the possibility to seek fulfillment without facing barriers based on structural inequalities. A second and closely related common feature of socialism has been a belief in the possibility of constructing an alternative egalitarian system based on the values of solidarity and cooperation. But this, in turn, has depended on a third characteristic, a relatively optimistic view of human beings and their ability to cooperate with one another. The extent, both of the optimism and its necessity for the construction of a new society, varies considerably. For those who believe in the possibility of establishing self-governing communities without hierarchy or law, the optimistic conception of human nature is essential. For others who have favored hierarchical parties and states, such optimism could be more limited. It is also no doubt true that in the world after Nazism and Stalinism, the optimism of some earlier thinkings has been tempered by harsh realities. Nevertheless, socialists have always rejected views that stress individual self-interest and competition as the sole motivating factors of human behavior in all societies at all times. They have regarded this perspective as the product of a particular kind of society, rather than as an ineradicable fact about human beings. Finally, most socialists have been convinced that it is possible to make significant changes in the world through conscious human agency. It is true that some interpreters of Marx have stressed economic determinism to such an extent that their belief in the role of people in bringing about change has sometimes been difficult to discern. Nevertheless, in general, passive resignation to the existing situation is alien to socialists. They have shared this view with capitalists and liberals, while opposing them in other respects. For capitalism, liberalism, and socialism are all products of the modern era, in their belief that human beings may act as subjects of history, rather than having their fortunes determined by fate, custom, tradition, or religion. These common characteristics help to distinguish socialism from other doctrines, ideologies, and systems, but it is also very diverse. This is not surprising when its evolution and development are considered. If modern socialism was born in 19th century Europe, it was subsequently shaped by and adapted to a whole range of societies. For example, the emergence of communism as a separate strand of socialism following the revolution in Russia in 1917 strengthened its appeal in many developing countries that were still controlled by European empires. However, communism was also to assume different forms as it was tailored to local conditions and merged with movements for national independence. Long before the Chinese communists assumed control of the country in 1949, it was clear that their new leader, Mao Zedong, 1893 to 1976, had emphasized the continuing role of the peasantry to a much greater extent than his Soviet counterparts. And by the 1960s, there were serious clashes between these two communist superpowers. Meanwhile, other communist regimes that had emerged in North Korea and Vietnam were shaped by specific conditions of civil war, struggles for national liberation, and American intervention. Elsewhere, quite different forms of socialism emerged. For example, some of the Jewish settlers in Palestine sought to establish small-scale cooperative communities in the so-called kibbutz movement, long before the establishment of Israel in 1948. Subsequently, many Arab states, beginning with Egypt in the 1950s, turned to a version of secular socialism, modernizing dictatorship, and nationalism, fueled in part by the existence of Israel and Western domination. In post-colonial Africa, particularly in Ghana in 1957 and Tanzania in the 1960s, quite different attempts were made to marry elements of socialism with local traditions. Similarly, in Latin America, various experiments have been tried, but have normally been defeated, particularly because of the overwhelming power and presence of the United States. The most enduring exception, to which particular attention will be paid in Chapter 2, is that of Cuba under Fidel Castro, which, since 1959, has combined a national social revolution with elements of the Soviet model. Ideally, a book on socialism would discuss the whole world, but this is clearly not possible in a very short introduction. There are also many important issues, perhaps particularly those concerning ethnicity, nationalism, and global inequality, that cannot be addressed adequately here. Instead, I have attempted to examine some aspects of socialism in more depth than would be possible in a general survey, and have also made use of case studies. Chapter 1 looks at the foundations of the doctrine by examining the contribution made by various traditions of socialism in the period between the early 19th century and the aftermath of the First World War. The two forms that emerged as dominant by the early 1920s were social democracy and communism, and Chapter 2 analyzes the experience of Sweden in relation to the former, and Cuba in relation to the latter. Despite their dominance, both communism and social democracy were increasingly challenged from the 1960s, and Chapter 3 seeks to elucidate this by exploring two further case studies, feminism and the Green Movement. These new social movements raised both theoretical and organizational issues that had not previously been addressed, or addressed sufficiently. Traditionalists feared that these movements would fragment socialism, but I will argue here that they also enriched it. The final chapter seeks to explain the pressures on socialism during the last quarter century, and to account for its current difficulties. It ends by reconsidering some key ideas in the light of experience, and suggests the kind of socialism that will remain relevant in the 21st century. Chapter 1. Socialist Traditions. Some have traced the origins of socialist doctrine to Plato, others to Christianity, and many with greater plausibility to radical movements in the English Civil War in the 17th century. However, modern socialism, with its evolving and continuous set of ideas and movements, emerged in early 19th century Europe. The reasons for this have long been debated, but it is widely agreed that very rapid economic and social changes associated with urbanization and industrialization were of particular importance. These not only undermined the rural economy, but also led to a breakdown of the norms and values that had underpinned the traditional order. Liberals of the era welcomed this transformation, regarding capitalist enterprise and the new individualism as the embodiment of progress and freedom. However, socialists dissented from two aspects of the liberals' outlook. First, rather than individualism, they tended to emphasize community, cooperation, and association, qualities that they believed to be jeopardized by contemporary developments. And second, rather than celebrating the proclaimed progress arising from capitalist enterprise, they were preoccupied by the massive inequality that it was causing. As former peasants and artisans were herded into overcrowded towns and forced to work in new factories for pitifully low wages. It was in this context that the term socialist was first used in the London Cooperative magazine in 1827. which suggested that the great issue was whether it was more beneficial that capital should be owned individually or held in common. Those who believed the latter were the communists and socialists. This chapter will examine some of the distinct traditions that then emerged. The Utopians. The label utopian was subsequently attached to some of the early socialists by Karl Marx and Frederick Engels. It was intended to convey negative attitudes toward them, suggesting naivete and a failure to root their ideas in rigorous social, economic, and political analysis. More generally, the notion of utopianism has often been used to dismiss projects regarded as unrealistic or fanciful. However, its usage here does not imply acceptance of these pejorative connotations. On the contrary, in my view, utopianism is an essential element in any project for social transformation, including socialism, and today's utopia often becomes tomorrow's reality. The most obvious common feature in the utopian socialists' transformative projects was the belief that a society based on harmony, association, and cooperation could be established through communal living and working. Such communities were set up in both Europe and America, and though they had mixed success, the most important contribution of the utopians as a whole was their delineation of projects for a new society that were actually put into practice. The utopians' ideas and the communities that attempted to carry them out foreshadowed later forms of socialism. However, those who were the most influential at the time did not necessarily produce the most enduring ideas. In terms of contemporary support, Étienne Cabet was probably the most popular, but his notion of utopia now appears drab. Cabet, 1788 to 1856, was born in Dijon, and after working as a lawyer, he became a campaigner for workers' rights. In 1834, he was prosecuted for writing an anti-monarchist article and was exiled to England for 5 years. While there, he read Thomas More's Utopia, 1516, and this inspired him to write his own utopian novel, Voyage to Icaria, 1839. All Icarians were to form a society founded on the basis of the most perfect equality with all aspects of life, including clothing, demonstrating these principles. While the degree of regulation and uniformity might now seem repellent, Cabet's Icaria was also highly democratic in terms of the popular participation it envisaged, and at a time when the French working class was suffering from extremes of destitution, it appeared to offer hope for a far better future. With between 100 and 200,000 adherents, this was also the most working class of all the utopian socialist movements, attracting fairly low-status artisans, fearful of their position with the development of modern factories. Icarian societies were established all over France, and a group also sailed to America in 1848, with one community remaining there until the end of the 19th century. However, while Cabet had considerable contemporary influence, the key utopians in terms of longer-term impact were Henri de Saint-Simon, Charles Fourier, and Robert Owen. Henri Saint-Simon, 1760 to 1825, was a French aristocrat who defied the conventions of his social class as a student. Imprisoned by his father for refusing to take communion, he escaped, joined the army, and fought against the British in the American War of Independence. Influenced by the relative absence of social privilege in America, he renounced his title at the beginning of the French Revolution and became convinced that science was the key to progress. His hope, expressed in his letters from an inhabitant of Geneva, 1802 to 1803, was that it would be possible to develop a society based on objective principles. His critique of existing society focused on the continuing semi-feudal power relationships in French society, rather than on capitalism itself. But his belief in classes as the primary categories of analysis, and his emphasis on the possibility of providing a scientific understanding of historical development, had clear relevance for Marxist theory. However, unlike Marx, he did not see ownership as the most important issue. In his view, history was really based on the rise and fall of different productive and unproductive classes in the various eras. In his own time, he grouped together the overwhelming majority of society, from factory workers to the owners of those factories, as productive, while the minority of idlers, including the nobility and the clergy, were unproductive. Progress now depended upon the productive classes, the industrial scientific class, becoming aware of their mission so that they could effect a transition to the new era. However, this was not simply a replacement of one class by another, as Saint-Simon argued that the industrialists and scientists had a wholly different set of relationships with one another than those between members of the feudal classes. The latter based their position on power, while the industrial scientific class emphasized cooperation and peaceful competition. The fact that the feudal class still maintained its position was thus a barrier to economic progress and new forms of government. During his lifetime, Saint-Simon's ideas tended to appeal more to some sectors of the middle classes, who were attracted by the modernizing aspects of the theory, than to the working class, who were perhaps discouraged by his secular tone in a religious age. This was remedied to an extent in his later work, in which he proposed a religion of Newton, in recognition of Newton's role as the founder of modern science. Scientists and artists should head a new church, and he even sought to combine a secular morality with a regenerated form of Christianity, claiming that the main goals were to eradicate poverty and to ensure that all benefited from education and employment. This widened the appeal of his ideas, and immediately after his death, Saint-Simonian communities were established in France and elsewhere. Made illegal in France in 1830, they nevertheless continued to have influence up to 1848, with approximately 40,000 adherents. The Saint-Simonian emphasis on industrialism and administrative efficiency as the key to progress and social justice influenced thinking in many other countries, including that of the writer Dostoevsky and other radicals in Russia. Charles Fourier, 1772 to 1837, also saw himself as a realist who believed that he had discovered fundamental laws that needed to be implemented to create a new society. However, his ideas were totally different from those of Saint-Simon, and there was a vast gulf between the world he sought to create and his own life. Born in Besançon, the son of a cloth merchant, he lived humbly in boarding houses and probably never had a sexual relationship. But the utopia that he envisaged, which he called harmony, was focused on feelings, passions, and sexuality, and perhaps had more points of contact with the movements of the 1960s than with the emerging working class of his own era. Believing that most problems arose from the mismatch between people's passions and the ways in which society functioned, he thought it possible to resolve this conflict through the establishment of so-called phalanxes, or communes. On the basis of a calculation of the number of personality types that he believed to exist, he concluded that just over 1,600 people would be the optimum size of each phalanx, for this would enable all passions to be satisfied and all necessary work to be carried out. Fourier's basic belief was a conviction that people did not need to change, The problem was the stifling impact of current society, which was the primary cause of human misery. Fourier also condemned the oppression of women, believing this to reveal the malfunctioning of the social system. He did not emphasize the importance of social and economic inequality as a fundamental cause of conflict, assuming that this could be overcome if everybody had a basic minimum, an approach he thought compatible with private property. His comparative lack of interest in the issues of class and inequality meant that Fourierism was the least popular of the movements of early socialists, and there were few factory workers amongst his followers. But his belief that human unhappiness was caused by psychological and sexual problems, and that the remedy lay in changes in society rather than by treating the individual, certainly anticipated many later forms of socialism. Like Fourier, Robert Owen, 1771 to 1858, also believed that society, rather than the individual, was responsible for human misery and social ills. But unlike him, Owen believed that people could and should change. The son of a saddler and ironmonger in Wales, he soon revealed an exceptional flair for business, achieving great success in the cotton industry. In 1799, he bought some cotton mills in New Lanark, in Scotland, and it was here that he put his ideas into practice. If Saint-Simon's critique of existing society was based on a kind of class analysis, and Fourier's on the stifling of passions, Owen's owed far more to the condemnation of irrationalism. His enduring belief was in a form of environmental determinism that meant that people were not responsible for their own characters, which were molded by the circumstances in which they lived. In his view, the dominant influences in current society were those of religious dogma and laissez-faire economics. He thought that people would act in superstitious and selfish ways because the whole environment promoted such behavior. In A New View of Society, 1813 to 1816, he claimed that, when he arrived at New Lanark, the population possessed almost all the vices and very few of the virtues of a social community. Theft and the receipt of stolen goods was their trade, idleness and drunkenness their habit, falsehood and deception their garb. They united only in a zealous, systematic opposition to their employers. In order to change all this, his innovations included the upbringing of children, the approach to crime, the design and location of buildings and leisure facilities, the relationships between the sexes, and the way in which work was organized. His claim was that by introducing such changes, based on the principles of rationality and cooperation, behavior would be transformed. After 16 years, a complete change had indeed been brought about in the general character of the village, of approximately 2,000 inhabitants, around the mills. Furthermore, he was quite certain that his principles could be extended to a much wider community and that the members of any community may by degrees be trained to live without idleness, without poverty, without crime, and without punishment. For each of these is the effect of error in the various systems prevalent throughout the world. They are all necessary consequences of ignorance. Viewed in one way, at this stage Owen was an enlightened business entrepreneur who wanted to increase his own profits by generating more productivity from his workforce. Certainly his approach was deeply paternalist and even patronizing, as he talked of inducing good behavior amongst the lower orders, and he would continue to reveal such attitudes in later life. But although he sought to convince other employers, the church and the government of the benefits to be gained by adopting his principles, their response was one of deep hostility. The notion of the perfectibility of human beings was held to undermine the Christian belief in original sin, and his emphasis on the social responsibility of employers to their workers was quite out of keeping with the laissez-faire approach of the capitalism of the era. After failing to win support, his ideas became even more radical, and he now attacked the system of private property and profit. In their place, he advocated the establishment of new cooperative communities of between 500 and 1,500 people, which would combine industrial and agricultural production. He also believed that it would be possible to abolish money and to replace it with labor notes, which would represent the time spent in work and would be exchangeable for goods. By now he was seeking to extend his ideas far beyond Britain, undertaking a continental tour in 1818 and traveling to America, where he established the first of several communities in New Harmony, Indiana, in 1825. Meanwhile, the London Cooperative Society was also established during the 1820s to promote his thinking, and exchanges were set up throughout Britain in which a system of barter took place. Although these did not meet with great success, by the time he returned to Britain from America in 1829, he had gained a significant level of working-class support, particularly when he joined the movement for trade unionism. However, his influence declined after he broke away from this movement in 1834 and failed to support working-class political demands. His condemnation of the institutions, economic system, and values of contemporary Britain remained wide-ranging, for he continued to argue that these promoted destructive individual self-interest rather than rational cooperation. But he believed that the primary cause was ignorance rather than malevolence or class interest, and he was often as critical of the workers as the elites. This weakened his appeal at a time when many believed that pressure and conflict would be the only way to bring about change. However, Owen's emphasis on the importance of nurture rather than nature in its widest sense has subsequently been a very considerable influence on a whole range of socialist thought. Saint-Simon, Owen, and Fourier each presented only a partial critique of existing society, and the same might be said of other early socialists. However, taken together, Saint-Simon's analysis of historical evolution through the category of class, Owen's emphasis on environmental determinism, and Fourier's recognition of the significance of forms of social repression provided important elements in later socialist analyses. The utopian socialists were also conscious of the interconnections between the various dimensions of the problems in existing society. This meant that they did not seek amelioration through partial measures. There needed to be a transformation rather than piecemeal social reform. Though few of the utopian socialist communities survived beyond the middle of the century, they were of enormous importance in formulating and promoting ideas for a cooperative future society in which ordinary people would play a major role. The utopians made a considerable contribution to socialism by focusing on the specific values of cooperation, association, and harmony in a context of egalitarianism. In the case of Owen and Fourier, this included an emphasis on sexual equality. And there were also some similarities between the utopians' creation of small-scale communities and later ecological thought. They should therefore be regarded as founders of elements of an alternative tradition that would reappear in such communities as the kibbutz in Palestine, Israel, the communes of the 1960s and 1970s, and in the Green Movement. They were progenitors of ideas that would be pursued at the margins for much of the 20th century. Anarchism. Anarchism covers a very wide spectrum of opinion, and not all anarchists are socialist in any sense. Here I will focus on a distinctive form of anarchism which was associated above all with Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, 1809 to 1865, and Mikhail Bakunin, 1814 to 1876. Apart from reinforcing the utopian vision of decentralized communities, its main contributions to socialism were in its intransigent opposition to the state, and its belief that a revolutionary movement should prefigure the society it wished to create. As will be shown, such views contained a critique of the forms of socialism that would subsequently become dominant. Like Fourier, Proudhon was born in Baise-Saison in southeastern France, and his outlook was essentially rural. However, his fundamental values were in total contrast to those of Fourier. He was anti-feminist, anti-homosexual, and extremely puritanical. His ideal society remained one in which independent, self-supporting peasants would study and live in rather basic conditions. However, in social and political terms, he was far more radical than most of the utopian socialists. His phrase, "What is property? Property is theft," which first appeared in his pamphlet, "What is Property?" 1840, was one of the best-known revolutionary slogans of the 19th century. Here he wrote about government. "Free association, liberty, limited to maintaining equality in the means of production and equivalence in exchange, is the only possible form of society, the only just and the only true one. Politics is the science of freedom, the government of man by man, under whatever name it is disguised, is oppression. The high perfection of society consists in the union of order and anarchy." His later works were more complex, but the basic continuity in Proudhon's belief was that labor should be the basis for social organization, and that all systems of government are oppressive. As he explained in The Philosophy of Poverty, if people worked for just themselves and their families, there would be no exploitation because nothing would be produced for employers, who had no real function. The first step for the restoration of healthy economic relationships between people was to abolish the whole existing structure of credit and exchange. This would also restore the dignity of labor, currently undermined by machines and the exploitation arising from the capitalist system. Proudhon believed that centralized states and governments were inextricably connected with the economic system, for governments worked hand in hand with the capitalists against ordinary people. When considering the future, he sometimes appeared to believe in a minimal central government formed from delegations from communes, while at other times he envisaged an arrangement whereby a temporary central structure would facilitate the establishment of a new system and then disband. Towards the end of his life, Proudhon devoted his efforts to considering some type of federal system linking the communities. Such ideas represented an attempt to bypass the state by establishing new structures that could carry out all the necessary social functions, thereby rendering the state itself unnecessary. His anarchism had become a real political force amongst a large section of the working class in France by the 1860s, when the doctrine also entered into the mainstream of European socialism and radicalism. However, it was Bakunin who really challenged Marxism for ascendancy in the developing working class movements. Bakunin was born about 150 miles from Moscow into a conservative noble family, but was a constant rebel. He met Proudhon, Marx, and other radical intellectuals in Paris in 1840, and read and discussed current socialist and revolutionary works. However, probably always more interested in action than thought, he became involved in the 1848 revolutions in Europe, securing an international reputation as a result. Bakunin sometimes advocated terror for its own sake, and certainly shares some responsibility for anarchism's later association with violence. But his ideas were also important. By now, Marx and Engels had published the Communist Manifesto and were endeavoring to influence the European working classes. Some of the key features in Bakunin's thinking were highlighted by his conflicts with the Marxists in the 1860s and early 1870s. The contribution of Marx and Engels will be explored in the next section, but Bakunin's major disagreements with them can be elucidated here. The first of these concerned their overwhelming emphasis upon the industrial working class in the most advanced capitalist societies as the revolutionary class. Bakunin believed that it was the most oppressed who were potentially the most revolutionary. This meant that revolutionary change was most likely in countries that were the least developed economically. In his view, Russian peasants were therefore in a strong position, and he argued that they also had traditional forms of organization in village communal structures that could provide a basis for socialism. Similarly, having spent 3 years in Italy from 1864 to 1867, he identified great revolutionary potential there because the workers were less privileged and bourgeois than elsewhere. Such people, worn out by daily labor, ignorant and wretched, renamed socialist without knowing it, and were really more socialist than all the bourgeois and scientific socialists put together. Bakunin's other major conflict with Marxism focused on issues of organization, both before and after the revolution. In 1864, Marx drew up the founding statement for the first socialist international, the International Working Men's Association. Bakunin had joined the international, but then formed a subgroup within it to try to inspire its members with revolutionary fervor. He opposed Marx's ideas of creating a communist party to win support for socialism. And in 1868, he declared that he hated communism because it is the negation of liberty and because I can conceive nothing human without liberty. I am not a communist because communism concentrates all the powers of society into the state, because it necessarily ends in the centralization of property in the hands of the state, while I want the abolition of the state, which, on the pretext of making men moral and civilized, has up to now enslaved, oppressed, exploited, and depraved them. Bakunin wanted loosely organized secret societies rather than mass political parties. The culmination of the conflict between Bakunin and Marx took place in the aftermath of the brutal crushing of the Paris Commune in 1871, in which workers had taken direct control of affairs in the city, combining legislative and executive power and passing a series of radical measures. Bakunin had taken this as an expression of his own ideas, viewing it as the beginning of a communalist movement which could spread over France as a form of the federalism envisaged by Proudhon. Marx was also deeply influenced and impressed by the Commune, but after its suppression, he believed that it was time to turn the International into a more organized working-class political party. This move was aimed directly at Bakunin, whose influence remained strong, particularly in Spain, Italy, and Switzerland. And anarchism was soon defeated by Marxism as the major influence over European socialist movements. anarchism would remain important in certain areas, above all in Spain, until it was crushed by both Franco and the communists in the civil war between 1936 and 1939. There and elsewhere, it would also coalesce with forms of trade unionism in the syndicalist and anarcho-syndicalist movements, which believed that power could and should be achieved by the workers themselves, rather than through political parties and the state. Like utopian socialism, anarchism also influenced some forms of decentralization and community-based movements from the 1960s. Less positively, during the latter part of the 19th century, it often became associated with futile and counterproductive violent acts against individuals, an approach also adopted by some anarchist-inspired groups in late 20th century Europe, including the Red Army fraction in the Federal Republic of Germany and the Red Brigades in Italy. However, the anarchist critique of hierarchical organization remains important. Thus, when Marx was attempting to eliminate anarchist influence from the International, some of Bakunin's followers asked, "How can you expect an egalitarian and free society to emerge from an authoritarian organization? It is impossible. The International, embryo of future human society, must be from this moment the faithful image of our principles of liberty and federation, and reject from its midst any principle leading to authority and dictatorship." It was certainly a vast exaggeration to suggest that Marx sought to create a dictatorship over the International, or was in a position to do so. But this anarchist cri de cœur would certainly have some great relevance in relation to the parties and states created by some of those inspired by Marx in the 20th century. And more generally, anarchism provides a perpetual warning for all movements. Beware the trappings of power. Beware bureaucracy. And ensure that authority is always distrusted. Apart from its vision of decentralized, self-governing organizations, this was its essential contribution to socialism. Marxism. The collaboration of Marx, 1818 to 1883, and Engels, 1820 to 1895, produced the most significant theory in the history of socialism. However, their work has always been open to a variety of interpretations, and dogmatic readings have had greater political resonance than more subtle ones. Since the aim here is to explain the role of Marxism in relation to the evolution of socialist traditions, this section concentrates on its most influential contribution, rather than attempting to explore the theory as a whole. In this respect, it is necessary to focus on its critique of capitalism and its explanation of why this system would eventually be replaced by socialism. The partnership between Marx and Engels was one of the most productive in history, but the differences between the two men were remarkable. Marx was the descendant of a line of rabbis on both sides of the family, and his father had only converted to Christianity to maintain his job as a lawyer. Engels was the eldest son of a successful German industrialist who was a fundamentalist Protestant. Marx showed exceptional academic promise and was denied a university career only because of his political views. Engels was forced to join the family firm by his father and was largely self-educated. Marx was untidy, careless about his own appearance, and had almost illegible handwriting. Engels was neat, well-organized, smartly dressed, and wrote very clearly. Marx married Jenny von Westphalen, the daughter of a baron. Engels remained single for most of his life, only marrying Lizzie Burns, a poorly educated working-class woman, on her deathbed in 1878. Yet from 1844 the two men were political and intellectual collaborators and close friends. Engels had subsequently been overshadowed by Marx. In fact, he said himself that he had always played second fiddle, and been happy to have had such a wonderful first violin as Marx. Certainly, it was an unequal relationship in some respects, with Engels running his family's factory in Manchester in order to support Marx financially while he studied and wrote. Marx was also the more original thinker, but Engels certainly made an indispensable intellectual and political contribution to the partnership. The critique of capitalism was embedded in an historical theory, historical materialism, that attempted to explain the whole development of human society. One of Marx and Engels' major criticisms of both the utopian socialists and the anarchists was that they did not deal adequately with the ways in which the present was rooted in the past. Only if these were understood, they believed, was it possible to understand the dynamic processes that would lead to its overthrow. In his Preface to a Critique of Political Economy, 1859, Marx explained, "In the social production of their life, men enter into definite relations that are indispensable and independent of their will. These relations of production correspond to a definite stage of development of their material powers of production. The sum total of these relations of production constitutes the economic structure of society, the real foundation, on which rise legal and political superstructure, and to which correspond definite forms of social consciousness. The mode of production in material life determines the general character of the social, political, and spiritual processes of life. It is not the consciousness of men that determines their existence, but on the contrary, their social existence determines their consciousness." This passage should not be taken to mean that Marx ignored the whole system of ideas, laws, politics, superstructure, for he examined all this in great detail. But he always related this superstructure to the prevailing economic system. Thus, in any social system, such as slave society, feudalism, capitalism, the general ideas and institutions corresponded to the mode of production and were in a sense functional to it. Each system contained a ruling class whose position was derived primarily from controlling the economic surplus, and the dominant ideas and institutions were those that accorded with the interests of that class. The historical theory also contained a theory of change through revolution. This was never simply identified with a period of violence, and as discussed below, the possibility of peaceful change was not precluded. Rather, Marx was arguing that such transformations as those from slave society to feudalism, or feudalism to capitalism, occurred over long historical eras. However, in the same work he also argued, "At a certain stage of their development, the material forces of production in society come into conflict with the existing relations of production or with the property relations within which they had been at work before. From forms of development of the forces of production, these relations turn to their fetters. Then comes the period of social revolution." For example, while technological advances and improved communications had made it possible for capitalism to develop in feudal Europe, the traditional systems of land ownership and taxation had inhibited those developments. Such structural tensions led to conflicts between the classes that were tied to the different economic systems. The existing feudal structure, or the embryonic capitalist, bourgeois one. These were expressed through political and ideological clashes, culminating in social revolution. Once the rising class had defeated the existing ruling class, it set about transforming the social relationships and superstructure in conformity with the new mode of production. For socialists, the really important part of the theory was, of course, the critique of capitalism itself, and the basis this provided for confidence about its eventual downfall. Again, the theory operated on a number of levels. In the Communist Manifesto, 1848, Marx and Engels suggested that there were only two antagonistic classes at the heart of the system. Our epoch, the epoch of the bourgeoisie, possesses this distinctive feature. It has simplified the class antagonisms. Society as a whole is more and more splitting up into two great hostile camps, into two great classes directly facing each other, bourgeoisie and proletariat. The suggestion was that all other groups, landowners, peasants, artisans, were being squeezed into one or other of these classes. Marx was not always so categorical about this, but certainly argued that it was the contradictory economic interests of these two classes that contained the seeds of destruction of the system. The starting point for the analysis was a theory of classical political economy, the labor theory of value. The argument here was that the value of a product was determined by the amount of labor that had been necessary to produce it. Marx began with this theory, and also thought that in pre-capitalist societies, products had been exchanged because they were useful to the people who bought them. However, he noted that this was not what happened under capitalism. Here, the point was to produce commodities which could be exchanged for money and profit. Furthermore, labor had also become a commodity to be bought and sold, but its exchange value was not as great as the exchange value of the product it created. This led Marx, from the 1850s, to argue that it was not labor that created value, but labor power. He also introduced the concept of surplus value. Put simply, his argument was as follows. Those who owned the means of production, for example, factories, sought profit by producing commodities for sale in the market. In the production process, they had two kinds of capital. Marx defined constant capital as that part of capital transformed into the means of production, that is, into raw material, accessory substances, and instruments of labor. In other words, constant capital consisted of such items as material, machinery, and buildings, and it did not change its value during the production process. However, variable capital, labor power, did change value. First, it was able to produce the equivalent of its own value, which, Marx assumed, was normally subsistence for the laborer and their family. If this was, say, 50 pounds per day, the worker would perhaps produce goods of such value within the first 4 working hours of that day. However, by working for another 4 hours each day, the laborer could produce double the value, that is, another 50 pounds. This would mean that 100 pounds of value had been produced, and the excess between subsistence and the amount taken by capitalists would be the surplus value, in this case 50 pounds. Profits came from surplus value, but some expenditure, for example on new machinery, would also be taken from it. The fundamental economic struggle between labor and capital was over the rate of surplus value, which Marx also called the rate of exploitation. With owners of the means of production wanting to increase it, and workers to reduce it through higher wages. The consequence of this conflict meant that the capitalist system was prone to crisis. If surplus value, and therefore profit, was derived only from labor power, there were persistent problems at the heart of the system. Individual capitalists would need to modernize their systems of production through improvements in machinery and technology so as to compete with their rivals. But this meant that they would want to increase their investment in constant capital, machinery, at the expense of labor, which would therefore mean that the share going to labor would decline. However, since surplus value was derived only from variable capital, labor, this meant that there was a long-term tendency for it to fall. The immediate problems could be offset by increasing either the hours of work or the productivity of labor. But in Marx's view, these were only temporary